Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Wessex Safety Hour hosted by Tracy Capstick. My name is Dave and I'm your event manager. During the presentation, your lines will remain on listen only, but if you require assistance at any time, please key star zero on your telephone and a coordinator will be happy to assist. I would like to advise all parties this conference is being recorded. Now I'd like to hand over to Tracy. Please go ahead.
Good morning or good afternoon, Wessex Route. I hope everybody is well this fine day. Those of you that have been listening to the Safety Hour since its inception last year, will know that Chris Goodwin, S&T team leader from Guildford, is probably the most question asker in the history of this conversation. As a result, we have asked him to do a safety hour. So this safety hour is actually hosted by Chris and myself. And we're very fortunate because Chris is an S&T leader of some standing. He's been on the railway for 43 years. Now, what I would like is, after you have listened to what Chris has to say, a few questions is kind of very useful, because otherwise we're talking into the ether. So I'm going to hand over to the esteemed Chris Goodwin now for him to talk to you about his view of safety and some top tips for survival, I believe.
Right, good afternoon. In my time on the railway, I've always been quite passionate about safety. From the days of complaining, if you like, or reporting that the yellow fronts of trains were no longer visible, to how things are at the moment. In my time on the railway, I've been an instructor and I've conducted many safety courses, and in especially the PTS in the initial courses, I relied on a lot of my own experiences to try and tip people off as to what the dangers might be. And I was talking to Tracy earlier today about the closest close call that I've had with trains. And they relate really to familiarity breeding contempt. And we were doing things which now are completely, or should be, completely not considered at all. The rules now are different to how they were many years ago, and our vigilance to complying with the rules is much more than it was years ago. And I was telling her that the first one was, my first job was Eastleigh, in the signal panel there, and at that time we parked the vehicles on the downside, which is four running lines and several sidings away from the signal box. And the tradition was, although even at that time it wasn't supposed to be, the tradition was that you walked across the lines to get to the vehicles. And I was finishing a late turn, very, very carefully crossed the four open running lines, very carefully stepping over the four juice rails. And once you reach the sidings, there was a wire run, which acts as a trip wire. Very carefully crossed that and relaxed. I'm over all the worst parts, I'm away from the danger, and then came with inches of a rake of wagons, which was being propelled, hitting me, literally inches away from it. I had relaxed my guard, I thought the worst is over. I made the assumption that that was it, I was now safe, but I wasn't. And that's probably physically the closest I've come to being hit by a train. Now, the second one was not that many years later, a Saturday night job. And it was on Hamble Viaduct, which is on the line between Fareham and St. Denis, Southampton, where we stood around before we went onto the line debating, has the last train gone or hasn't it? Now, in amongst the party for the job that we were doing was the local supervisor. Well, we decided that, yes, looking at the time, the last train had gone. So we climbed up, went through the gate, fence, whatever. We all had tilly lamps, and we got onto the track at the beginning of the viaduct. Within seconds, suddenly there is a train coming round the bend. It's on a curve. The driver must have seen the tilly lamps right at the last moment and was giving his series of urgent warnings, toots on his horn and we scattered. Tilly lamps went everywhere, and luckily, purely luckily, out of it, none of us were hit, none of us were injured. And talking to Tracy earlier, we were considering that that sort of situation was because the supervisor was with us, the rest of us didn't really think. We thought, the supervisor's here, he's making the decisions, we're safe. Of course, nowadays, with telephones, we would never, ever consider doing that. We would never have to stand beside the track and debate, has the last train gone or hasn't it? But those are the two closest in my 43 years on the railway that I think I've come.
So top tips for... They were a few years ago, Chris.
They were a few years ago.
In today's world, would I be right in taking from that that the moment you relax is problematic?
That's when the problem could start, the moment you relax, yes.
And go on, sorry.
And the moment you make assumptions that somebody else solely is looking out for you, not looking at as in look at, is solely looking after your safety, again, is the mistake.
What sort of scenarios would occur today, do you think? What assumptions do we make today?
Well, reading through the safety shield, again, recently somebody else has not tested before touch and they have put scraps on juice rails that are not isolated. People are still making the assumption that because a piece of paper says so, or because it happened by this time last night, that the juice is going to be off. So people are still making these assumptions.
Did that ever happen to you?
What?
When you assumed that something was not live when it was.
It didn't come to an incident as such, but I have been given, in the past, many years ago, I've been given a conductor route permit for a stretch of track that wasn't isolated. What had happened was, during the night, a whole area had been isolated, and at about 7 o'clock in the morning, part of that had been lifted to allow limited train service into one of the platforms only. Now, the permit that we were given, we were doing some work on points, the permit we were given included all the lines at this particular location, and as we were making our way over to the site, what should come around the corner? An electric train, which clearly told us that we didn't have a full isolation in the area that we were told. Probably we hadn't got, in those days it was a box of eggs, although this wasn't that many years ago, whether we would have actually tested the conductor rail on that occasion before getting too close to it, I can't really say now, because as I said, the train came around the corner and told us that certainly it was not switched off in those areas. Nobody seemed particularly contrite about giving us the conductor rail permit, and nobody really showed much interest. It shows how different things are nowadays. With our close call regime, I cannot see that that would have just been left as it was in those days.
So do you see a benefit in the close call regime?
I certainly see that, yes. I see that people are being vigilant for whatever reason. They are being, because they're passionate for safety, because they're passionate for other people's safety, people are more vigilant as to what is going on around them, what they're doing, what other people are doing, and what could cause problems.
What do you think the biggest risk faced by S&Ts are at the moment?
Many S&T will say the third rail is our biggest problem. Another illustration of familiarity or letting your guard down, where the conductor rail has been gapped by point machines, often the gap is very small between the point machine and the end of the conductor rail. And you can get carried away, especially at night, working on the point machine, and you are in fact inches from stepping back onto the conductor rail. So, as I say, many S&T people consider that the third rail is the biggest risk. There are other places where the third rail is in the 6 foot side, on the 6 foot side, on the assess side, and there is a very high ballast shoulder, which makes it quite difficult to step over the conductor rail to get on or off the track, especially with high ballast shoulders, which are likely to give way under you. So, yeah, many of us see that the conductor out is a bigger threat than the trains. I think with the S&T, often where we work, we have the advantage of knowing the signalman, knowing what's going on, and being in close touch with the signalman for things that we do. So we have that benefit. But the third rail is always there. During most of the time that we work, it is actually switched on. And I personally have an extremely healthy respect for the third rail, but just wish that we didn't have this problem, because I'm not a tall person. If anybody knows me, I'm not a tall person, and I don't like almost doing the splits over the conductor rail. One of the other things that have interested me, and I've mentioned on these safety calls, is planning in safety for the future, realising that it costs money to do things, maybe move the conductor rail to the 6-foot side where it wouldn't cause that sort of problem. Where we have these high ballast shoulders does tend to be on nice curves. So if you're going to work, you want to be able to get out quite quickly sometimes, or within a reasonable time. And I've often wondered, well, next time this particular stretch of line does come up for renewal, why don't they plan to move the conductor rail over, move it to a safer position? And I wonder if there is any mechanism for making the suggestions, for it being considered, 2 years, 5 years, even 10 years down the road, that when some work is done, it can be made safer. From the early safety hours, one of the things that I spoke about was working at height. And another thing that I wonder about is when they're designing off indicators on platforms, when they're designing certain structures, that they are made almost unmaintainable without putting whoever's going to maintain them or fault them into some element of danger. Why can't things be designed to be safely maintained is one of the things that I've always sort of stepped back and wondered at. It's possibly because there's no machinery for doing it. What do you think?
I think in this day and age, design should be incorporated.
Design for safety.
Design for safety should be incorporated into signal structures. So I would hope that we don't do that anymore, but I think it's possibly a question that has to be asked, Chris.
Yeah.
To make sure that this is correct now. So we'll take that away. Now, improved positions of safety for S&T. Do you think it is primarily S&T that need better walkways because you work more in the day?
We work more in the day. During the day whilst trains are running, the other people who tend to be on the track are the P-Way patrolmen.
Yeah.
And their regime for patrolling is they have a distant lookout and they have their rolling sight lookout, and they're generally more geared up for walking great distances in the forefoot.
Yeah.
So generally they are going to be patrolling from the forefoot. Because I've wondered why it's the P-Way who are spreading all this ballast everywhere. Why aren't they inconvenienced by it? And I think it's because they don't walk in the cess. We tend to do our inspections mostly from the cess.
Yeah.
And we are the ones who find we have nowhere to walk. Because of the increasing amounts of ballast which are necessary to keep the continuous welded rail in position, overwhelm our previous walking routes, which would have been the surface of the troughing, and in many cases begin to push that troughing down the bank because of the sheer weight of ballast. Again, I wonder, is nobody on the civil engineer side, is nobody looking at the unintended effect of piling more and more and more ballast on where it goes?
That brings me on the subject of troughing lids, Chris.
Troughing lids, yes.
Yeah, people walking on troughing.
Well, first of all, nobody said anything about walking on troughing lids, and then many years ago somebody tripped and it was forbidden to walk on troughing lids, but it was quickly realised that in many cases there was nowhere else to walk. So then in came the rule, you could walk on the troughing lids if you were sure that they were stable and not likely to cause you to trip or fall.
Right, okay, so this is one of those interesting debates. Should one walk on troughing lids or not? Because a lot of people will say, we will not, we're not allowed to. a lot of people will say, but it's probably the safest route.
It's probably the only route.
And some of the S&T get a bit precious about their troughing lids.
The troughing belongs to telecoms, not to the
S&T. So, do we think people should walk on troughing lids?
Ideally, there will be a safe walking route,
yeah,
as there is beside the railway, for example, in the Woking area, or it was safe when it was put in.
Yeah.
It's got overgrown. As I said many times, there is nowhere else to walk. So the responsibility is on the walker to ensure that the lids are not loose or missing or going to cause them more problems. But there is just nowhere else to walk very often. Cess is as they used to be many, many, many years ago, and even I wasn't around when they were, where you could cycle down the cess. They've long gone through the amount of ballast that has been necessary for the modern type of track and for the modern speed of trains. So it is a necessity often to walk on the troughing.
Right, thank you. Today's risks to S&T. Any additional risk today to S&T that potentially we rely on you guys making the best decision rather than supporting you?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head.
Okay. Improved position.
Top of my head's just come down a little bit. One thing that we have suffered from in the past is that at the end of a particular job, no time has been allocated for our testing.
Yeah.
And because we get such limited windows anyway, especially during the night for doing anything, they have said, well, it's not really possible to allow you an hour to test a track circuit or whatever. So very often the testing is done when the lines are open again.
Right, so the scenario I'm thinking of is when we've changed a rail, the S&T come in to do their miraculous S&T bit.
Yes.
We don't allow time for testing because we've got to give the road back. But then we have to go back in to do the testing before you can hand the signals back.
That's correct, yes, because the track circuit's unreliable until it's been tested and found to be within specification. I think then we rely on our relationship with the signalers, where we know them. And this is another remote fear of mine, that as we're moving towards rocks and as we're moving towards the anonymity of signalers controlling very wide areas, and we may never ever meet them. And you lose that little bit of security that you feel, because we still feel that that signalman who we know is looking after us, that signalman who we know we can trust.
Right, so in my world, this is how I think you should run. So you're told that you've done the work, the conductor rail permit's been handed back, they're going to give up the T3. And at that moment in time, in terms of protection, you need then to take the block line.
Yes.
But there is that moment of vulnerability, unless everything is done properly and everybody knows where they are, because it is not unheard of for the S&T not to be informed that the road has gone back.
All sorts of things can happen, yes.
Right, okay. So, in an ideal world, and the way it should run, is conductor rail permit cancelled. You are off track then until the T3 has gone back, and then you take signal protection. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Do you think we do that properly?
I can't speak for everybody, but I'm not convinced it is done properly all the time.
What are the holes in that? What are the potential for risk in that?
That you may not actually leave the track whilst the T3 is cancelled. You're probably still there.
Why would that be?
Because of where the exit gate is, because of where the ES is, all sorts of reasons.
Okay, but at that moment...
Convenience.
At that moment, we need particular clarity between ES, the cause for the S&T, the arrangements to hand back the permit, and how you are going to carry on that testing after it's gone back. Can you test it? Can you do that testing when you are still under T3?
If sometimes the track circuits, if the straps are on, you can't test the track circuit because the straps are there, and the straps are causing the track circuit to stay occupied. So no, it's one of those things where you have to remove the straps first.
Yeah, so you've got to give it back because then the straps go up.
Yes.
And actually you can't do the testing until that happens. Okay. Right. Dave? I've lost my man.
Yep.
Can you open up the lines to see if there are any questions for Chris at this point for me, please?
Thank you. Yeah, ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question, please key star 1 on your telephone keypad, record your name and press the hash key. That's star 1 on your telephone keypad, record your name and press the hash key. Thank you. There are no questions at this time.
Thank you, Dave. So, three things you want to get over for the safety of our staff. Go, Chris.
Don't relax your guard, and don't make assumptions. And the other one really is amongst this. It's is not relying wholly and solely on other people, but using your judgment to add to the safety that they provide.
And I will add one more, which is I need to give them a poke about the design of structures. It should have been sorted out, didn't I? And looking at improved positions of safety for S&T when they're working. So,
yes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Goodwin. We really appreciate that.
Thank you.
The Wessex Route.
Right.
Basically, we do have one question in the queue just while you were speaking there. Do you want to take a question? Yeah?
Yep.
Hello?
Yeah, it's from a line.
Ivan.
Please go ahead. Thank you.
Hello. It's Ivan Kimball here. So, thanks, Chris, for your comments and thoughts, etc. I just wondered, when we're faced by things that we don't think should go ahead, I'm thinking of the WorkSafe procedure. Have you ever raised the WorkSafe procedure, and what do you think we should do to make it more acceptable to raise the WorkSafe procedure, if that's not a perverse question? Yeah.
Yes, I have raised the WorkSafe procedure. It was connected with being asked to work at height in a situation which I didn't think was safe. I must say that the procedure I didn't think followed the route it should have done. I mean, ultimately, I refused to do it. Doesn't mean to say I wasn't asked at later dates to do exactly the same thing. So I do wonder how it was all supposed to have been tied up. So yes, I have invoked it, and I'm sorry to say that other people went ahead and did the work anyway, yet I thought and still believe that it was patently not safe and not within the rules.
Right, so who did you raise it with, your supervisor or...?
Yes.
Okay, so what do you, so there's a follow through, so there is a bit of paperwork to follow on a WorkSafe procedure, so you can raise it and you can come to an agreement how you can go ahead with it to do whatever it is safely, or you can not do it. How, you know, you can't reach that agreement and so we just don't do it, which is absolutely the right thing to do. How do you think we should encourage more people to invoke the WorkSafe procedure if they believe that's the right thing? How do we encourage people to do that?
Well, I can tell you the discouraging part of it is that in this particular case, the problem still existed. So somebody had to deal with it. And it, as has happened many times, it's a case of, well, he won't do it. Well, let's try him. Let's try her. Let's go down the list until we find someone who will. The problem is that the nub of the situation is not being tackled. And in this case, it was a structure which was unmaintainable within the rules. And therefore, something should have been done about the structure and wasn't, because either there's no machinery for doing it, or there's no money for doing it, or whatever. So to encourage people, I think you have to be seen to be at least addressing the problem for the future, or now, or whenever, for something to be done actually about it, rather than just wait for the next time it fails, and the number of what? The signal number was, can't remember now.
Oh, damn.
Yeah. I can tell you where it is.
I think this is really important. So, just like with a close call, if I want to carry on raising a close call, I want to see them close down as an individual. So that's why we track close calls and them closing down. And the same with WorkSafe procedure. If somebody raises a WorkSafe procedure, there has to be a way. It has to be closed down, and that's to make it safe to do whatever it is. And in this case, you're talking about working at height. So we have to track the WorkSafe procedure, and then we have to track how it's closed down, and not by just getting someone who is prepared to do it. It's either, you know, it's either safe to do something or it isn't, and so we need to, within the rules, etc. So we need to close that down for sure. It's just like close calls in that respect, but even more so. So it's tracking and closing down WorkSafe procedure numbers. And so, Tracy, maybe that's something we can put in the cascade brief, is about what, you know, how many have been raised and how we've closed them down or not, as the case may be.
Well, it's certainly encouraging that when I've raised close calls, particularly about douche rail boarding, it's very encouraging when eventually I see that the boarding appears. So that is quite rewarding, and that does encourage me to carry on, because I know that it's not just going into the ether, but somebody is taking notice of that, EMP in this particular case. But this example, and it's an off indicator, and it's on the down platform at Wokingham, it still exists as a problem. And I don't know what the company can do about it, but it still exists as a problem. The device still fails, so presumably somebody somewhere is still dealing with this device in a way which, as far as I can see, is not necessarily within the rules. And I would love to see that thing closed out.
That's a specific example, so Tracy, we'll take that away and dig into that one.
Yeah.
Okay. That's great. Thanks very much, Chris. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Right, Dave, if there are no more calls, we can probably let people go.
Okay, now there are no more questions at this time. So thank you, Tracy, and the other presenters, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen. That concludes your conference call for today. You may now disconnect. Thank you for joining, and have a very good day.